Thanks very much, and welcome to everybody who's joining us once again for our Wednesday Live Geek Speaks. As mentioned, my name is Glenn Gordon. I'm a developer evangelist at Microsoft based in Atlanta, Georgia. And my co-host on Geek Speak today is Andrew Duffy. Andrew, what's up?
Hey, Glenn. So my name is Andrew Duffy. I'm a developer evangelist for Microsoft's Mid-Atlantic District, and very, very pleased to have one of our local superstars with us today to talk dynamic languages. Kevin Hazard works for one of our local partners, Captech Ventures, and is a rock star speaker in the Richmond and Southern Virginia and elsewhere in Mid-Atlantic circuits, and is also one of the organizers for the upcoming Richmond Code Camp.
Fantastic.
Kevin, welcome.
Yeah, welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, Andrew.
So we're going to jump into the speak in just a bit, but I want to make sure people understand the format. We try to keep these webcasts very interactive, so Andrew and I meet up with lots of people in the various developer communities we interact with that are experts in quite a variety of technologies. And rather than have a webcast where it's very scripted and the PowerPoints kind of guide you through everything, we like to get these guests on the webcast, the GeekSpeak webcast, and give them an opportunity to sort of freeform and answer your questions and show some interesting demos and chat about technologies. And Andrew, as you mentioned, you've got a couple of code camps coming up, right? You've got Richmond coming up in a few weeks, right?
Yes, indeed. So Richmond's coming up on October 3rd. That's going to be at the J. Sargent Reynolds Community College off Parham Road in Richmond. And then the following week, October 10th, we have the Northern Virginia Code Camp is going to be held on the at our Microsoft Reston facility here, which is actually where I'm sitting right this very moment. And both of those events are coming up. You can find out more about Richmond Code Camp at richmondcodecamp.org, and for Northern Virginia, I believe it's novacodecamp.org. I'll double check that URL and make sure we get that up on the show site.
And you have those linked on your blog as well, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we've got, there's one coming up in the Carolinas down here in the southeast. I think it's October 10th, Charlotte Code Camp. Well, we really encourage folks to get out and attend code camps and become presenters, because that's how you start building your skills and becoming a guru. So, as mentioned, we've got a real guru with us today, Kevin. So, let's talk about your background a little bit, Kevin. How did you get into the development space, and what specifically got you interested in learning and presenting on dynamic languages?
Well, I got into development many years ago, sort of as a byproduct of being a mathematician. Undergraduate degrees in mathematics, and I love mathematics. And like most mathematicians, I was looking for a way to express myself. And of course, computers are great for that.
Right.
And sorry.
Go ahead.
So I got into software development in college, really, as they were looking for someone to manage the computer lab. And although I wasn't in the computer science program, I did that. And really enjoyed it, and my career, you know, just took off right after college. So I worked for Intel Corporation in the architecture labs, and I've worked for a lot of other sort of larger software companies. And today I'm in consulting. I think when you get to this stage of this kind of career, consulting makes a lot of sense, because I can take all these great things I've learned from other people who are, you know, I'm standing on their shoulders at this point, and take those to a lot of companies.
Right. Fantastic. So we've got a lot of folks who've tuned in today that I'm assuming are newbies when it comes to dynamic languages and .NET. And, I understand there's a couple of different directions people can take when they're considering .NET dynamic languages. And we were chatting a little bit before the call about the hybrid approach. So can you lead us into that a little bit, about how dynamic languages fit in with a solution somebody's trying to create and how they can best leverage them?
Sure. Well, you know, the key thing, I think, the thing I've been trying to emphasize with developers all up and down the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and through blogging and other outlets like that, is that we tend to think of applications, I think because of the way we do design, we tend to think of them sort of monolithically. Mm. And, you know, it's not uncommon to say, well, you know, that application's written in C#, or that application's written in Ruby, or, you know, we have these sort of monolithic approaches to software design. Reality is that software is more like a human body. You know, we have rigid bones and we have tendons and ligaments that are a little less rigid because they help us to get around. And software can benefit from that kind of design because we need structure from languages like C# and Visual Basic. And then having the flexibility to behave dynamically with languages like Ruby and Python mixed into that model is very compelling, especially when you think of, for example, a large-scale, let's just say, insurance adjustment application for adjudication of insurance claims. Mm-hmm. The business rules that drive that adjudication for insurance, for example, might need to change much more rapidly than the underlying application. Being able to, for example, express those rules in a language like Python or Ruby, or even a language that you want to make up in your domain, makes a lot of sense.
Do you think that a lot of folks already kind of have that background if they've been dealing with web apps or have to talk to a database? Because I'm thinking in the context of web apps, you've got your server-based language, whether it's ASP.NET or PHP or something else, and then you've got JavaScript on the client, and you're sort of creating a synergy between the two. And then maybe from the database perspective, you've got your C# or your VB app, and then you've got T-SQL that you're working with. So do you think that already sort of gives people a leg up on you know, realizing how dynamic languages are going to help them with their other types of languages in their project?
I think so, and as a great example, I actually use that example sometimes when I'm making my point. I'll ask, hey, what is, you know, so you did this this great web application, what's it written in? Most of the time they'll say Visual Basic or C#. And I'll say, well, what about HTML? What about JavaScript? What about Transact SQL? What about all these other languages that you're using? Well, I really wasn't thinking of like that is what they typically say. And they don't realize that they've already sort of constructed that body with, you know, sort of rigid bones and more flexible ligaments, if you will. So, you know, once they understand that, it's not a big leap to saying, well, maybe we could think about injecting some Python or some Ruby or, you know, pick the language of your choice, injecting some other language into the mix.
So, Kevin, I know we've got a question in the queue that I think is a good one to follow, just sort of to take a step back. One of the questions is, I'm so new to this, I want to know what a dynamic language is. So can you kind of succinctly define what's the distinction between a dynamic language and, you know, what sort of the mainstream or the static language, if you will, sort of net that out?
Sure. So the dynamic languages tend to have a set of qualities. Now, they don't all have the exact same qualities, of course, but one of the hallmarks is that they make decisions later in the process. So, for example, writing a function in C# or Visual Basic, I might declare it to say that it takes an integer parameter and returns a Boolean result. With dynamic languages, it's not that it's not important, but those types aren't important, but the actual types that are used at runtime are sort of evaluated at runtime for what they are. So the concept we have in static languages like generics, generic collections and things, they're kind of easier to pull that off in dynamic languages from a functional perspective because the functions don't necessarily care what kinds of parameters you pass. They'll evaluate them at runtime and figure that out. So the first thing people ask is, well, if they're doing all that at runtime, how's the performance? And that's kind of the point of this talk.
Okay, excellent. We got one more here from Bob. He says he's heard about discussions about moving VB6 to be one of the dynamic languages on .NET. Do you know anything about that, Kevin?
VB6 in particular?
Yeah, that was the question.
Well, I can't speak to, you know, exactly what the DLR team is doing. I do talk with them pretty often, but I know there's been a lot of requests to have Visual Basic as a scripting language, essentially, on the DLR. Mm. And I think I hear more outcry, actually, around JavaScript. People love Python, they love Ruby, but, you know, if you count the lines of JavaScript code that exist in the world because of browser-based applications, people really want JavaScript to be running on the DLR. So
right.
I think the DLR team is committed to adding some other languages in the future. I just don't know exactly when and which ones. There's been talk about both of those, but I can't commit, obviously, for them.
Okay.
Well, one last question before we push on. Frank asks, can you run automated tests in dynamic languages?
Yeah, in fact, so that's a really good question. Automated tests or unit tests, there's a library called PyUnit for Python unit testing that allows you to do unit testing using the Python language. It's actually a very compelling idea because wiring up unit tests with their preconditions and postconditions and all those things is it's a bit tedious in statically typed languages, and in Python it's a breeze. So a lot of people are looking at languages like Python for that exact thing, essentially establishing a framework for unit testing.
Okay. Well, cool. One thing I wanted to point out to all our listeners is that these questions and these links that we're discussing, we're going to make all those available in a blog post on our Geekspeak blog in a couple of days. So you can check back there for some references. So Kevin, did you want to go ahead and maybe share out your desktop and show us some dynamic languages in action?
Sure. Can you see my source code at this point?
Just keep click on your desktop share in the content pane.
Okay.
Go back into the live stream console there.
Content.
There we go.
Got it. And now you can see it.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay.
To set some context, you're using Visual Studio 2010 beta?
Yeah, this is the beta 1.
Because we're highlighting .NET 4. Okay, good.
Yeah, so there's things that you can do today with Visual Studio 2005 and 2008 mm-hmm. related to dynamic language integration. And one of the things I'd like to show, if we can, is one of the integration things that you can do today and how that sort of stitched together. Do we have time to show sort of a what can be done today with the tools that are available today?
Sure. I think a lot of folks are probably interested in seeing that.
Okay.
We can put a time on that.
So this first bit of code that I'm going to show is I'm showing it in Visual Studio 2010, but it runs perfectly well in Visual Studio 2005 and 2008. But I wanted to collect them all here so I didn't have to have both instances running. The idea, let me go ahead and run it, because probably seeing it is worth a lot more than just showing you the code first, and then we can dive back into the code.
And it looks like you've got the a comment in there about the source code being available on your blog, so we'll be sure to point folks to that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was left in. I appreciate that. So I have, apologize for the graphics. The one thing that I'm really, really not good at is designing user interfaces, so I apologize, but I do think that this little shopping cart demo will show you some interesting things. So I've got a collection of products here that came from a popular website. I'll let you guess what it is. And they're products with prices, and they're categorized by the type of product that they are. So I have some gadgets at the top, and then at the bottom of the list, I have some clothing items. So what I want to do is I really just want to start adding some items to the cart. And we can see that if I add one item, let me go ahead and make this a little bit larger. If I add one item, that I have a 0% discount applied. Mm-hmm. I'll go ahead and add another gadget, for example. And let's say this UV disinfectant wand. And we can see that I get a 7% discount now. Well, obviously that discount is being driven by some rules somewhere. Let's go ahead and take a look at those rules. I have a little rule editor here, which actually lets me edit a bit of Python code. And you can see that I'm able to establish some tiers. So these are just variables in the Python code that says, you know, the level for tier one is two products have to be in the cart. And if you add two products, we'll apply a 7% discount. If you add four products, we'll apply a 10% discount. Is that clear?
Yeah, it's interesting you would choose to do that in a language. I think a lot of people might try to do that with a database or some complex table in the database. But
Well, you could. And the really interesting idea there, Glenn, is that you could potentially have the database drive the creation of the code that actually implements it. Right? So that those values, 2, 4, 6, and 7, for example, for those tiers could actually be come from a database, but generate the Python code to run at runtime. Because the interesting thing here is that the actual code that I'm about to show you running is acting, it's Python code acting on the objects created in a C-sharp application.
Okay.
Okay? So let's just go ahead and do something like change the tier 1 level to 3. In other words, I'm saying you have to have 3 products in the cart to get that 7% discount. Now keep your eye on the percentages discount on the left here in the shopping cart. I'll commit those changes and you can see that the discount disappeared. Now that's real live code. That's essentially the shopping cart object, which is persistent in the shopping application, and the rule being committed back there and automatically being applied to recalculate the discounts, as it were.
Got it. So in a given scenario where you have developers that create a core system and usually have some hard and fast requirements that they're implementing their system to follow, and then you've got sort of the power user or an admin or something that might be editing these kind of rules, and these rules don't need maybe to be fully vetted with requirements. It can be more done on the fly. Is that the type of architecture you're looking at here, is that you're allowing the end user, a power user rather, to set up rules in the dynamic language?
Well, it's certainly one way to think about it. Obviously, if you were going to expose this to a business user, mm-hmm. you run the risk of their, introducing a typo that makes it not function. So there has to be some kind of layer between the submission of the code change
okay.
and the push to production. And so in environments like this that I create today, we typically have a promotion facility that says, just like with normal code, we promote that into a test environment. There's a set of unit tests and integration tests that are automated to validate that you get correct results. And then we can then promote that into a production environment eventually after, it's signed off on. Mm. So the other thing that's interesting about this concept is that not only could you allow them to write code, but you can provide graphical tools that write code. We hear a lot about so-called visual domain-specific languages nowadays.
Sure, yeah.
Well, so, for example, flowcharting is one that you find in almost every business. And flowcharting is the kind of thing where, you can imagine the flowchart pieces in a Visio diagram generating code behind it to execute. The user may never actually see the code. They would just drag and drop the flowchart shapes, which would generate the blocks of code that then go in and are executed by a C-sharp or visual-based code engine or a statically typed rules engine, if you will.
Gotcha.
So let's play around a little bit more before we get out of this demo. I'm going to say that the targets here are maybe 3, 5, and 7 products, and you get the extra 5% kicker when you add the 9th product. We'll go ahead and commit those changes, and we can then see, for example, if I start adding other products, I got the 7% discount at the 3rd product, 4th product still there at 7%, and we can continue that process. Now I hit the 5th product, I go to a 10% discount, and I'll just add a couple more of those. Notice that when I hit the 7 count item, I get the 13% discount, but if I now add clothing, because clothing doesn't qualify for these levels of discounts, it gets a 0% discount because that's essentially the way the rule is written. But as soon as I add the 9th item, I get that 5% discount that's applied across the entire cart.
Hmm.
You see that? And so that code is actually very easy to read. We can see we have our tiers and discounts and our bonus discount level. And then the actual code is getting the count for only gadget type items, and then getting the discount for the gadget items, and then setting all the discounts across the cart. Those are just 3 little Python functions up here that produce that result. Now notice that in every one of these cases, this thing that I'm acting on called cart, that's the actual C-sharp created object that was injected into the Python code.
Wow.
And I'm acting on that object live.
So the DLR, the runtime, is interpreting this code that you wrote here and applying it to those objects.
Yeah, I can create an object like a shopping cart in C# or VB, mm-hmm. essentially, for lack of a better term, inject that into the Python or Ruby scope, and then have that dynamic code act on that object created in the statically typed language.
Okay.
So it really is truly integrated.
Let's point out a little bit.
I don't have this situation where I have to call out into some command line environment to execute the dynamic language.
Okay. Before we get out of that window, let's take a look maybe at some of the code that's in there and the way it's structured, because there's a question here in the queue to have to learn the Python language to really use dynamic languages. So I guess the Python language itself, the implementation in dynamic language runtime, is called Iron Python, and the same thing for Ruby, that there's an Iron Ruby that runs in the DLR, right?
Right. So they are .NET implementations of Python and Ruby. They're actual fully compliant versions of those languages that run inside the .NET framework on the DLR.
And then, not to spend too much time on it, but the code that you were showing had indents and things like that. So how does that work in the context of Ruby? Or sorry, Python.
Well, so Python is one of those languages that people love and hate this about it simultaneously. It's white space sensitive. It's sensitive to white space, and it really cares about how you space things. Mm-hmm. The upshot of that, of course, is that it's a very clean read from top to bottom. You don't have begin and end statements or curly braces or anything getting in your way.
Or semicolons.
Well, you have colons to block off those blocks, but
right.
We don't have a lot of those other sort of decorations that other languages have. So people that write Python a lot love this about the language. They generally love the fact that it's not a highly decorated language. It really does flow, and it's very readable. The other thing that's great about
tab key is your friend.
That's right. Well, the tab keys are your friend as long as you convert the tabs into spaces.
Got it. Yeah.
It'll actually respect the tabs as well. But I tend to turn on virtual space and convert my tabs to spaces in the source code that's produced. So,
Kevin, one of the questions that came up from an attendee is, what if you're somebody who's not a Python developer from the outset? Is there a way to take advantage of dynamic languages today if you're not using Python or Ruby?
Well, the answer is yes, of course. The level of integration that you're going to get is highly dependent on where you start. The one thing that's really exciting about the DLR, what Microsoft has done, is the level of integration is so high. As you saw, I can inject a C# based or C# allocated object, plain old .NET object, into the Python space and then work on it as a first class object.
Let's take a step back there. How does someone get the DLR and how does the DLR function? So when you're writing a program, most folks who are familiar with the .NET platform understand the basics of how to build an application, build a DLL in C# or VB. What's different about the DLR?
Well, the DLR is, first of all, it's an entirely free product. You can go to ironpython.codeplex.com or dlr.codeplex.com. The source code for the DLR and Iron Python and Iron Ruby is completely open and available. And so you can build it yourself, or you can start with one of the installer packages. And when you install it, you'll get all of the compiled DLLs for Iron Python and the Microsoft scripting and scripting core. And you can essentially just start working in a text editor if you want, or you can start working in any number of other editors that are available for doing work in Python. If you want things like, color coding of your source code, mm-hmm. and things like that. What's different about Python is that it's really a completely open source language, if you will, and Microsoft has really adopted that philosophy around the DLR. You can get not only the source code for Python and Ruby languages themselves, but the actual DLR. Mm-hmm. It's all there. So hopefully we can get those URLs up on the GeekSpeak site when we're done.
Yep, we'll do that. I think you were getting ready to show us the code, how this actually gets run.
Yeah, so I just wanted to jump in real quick, and I've got a couple of other things I'd like to show, so I'll just be quick about this. But first of all, if we were to look at the code, there is the rule class that I've built, and the rule class is really the class that pulls together the interface to the actual rule. So here, what I've done, just for simplicity, for demo's sake, again, this could come from a database, but I've put in the rule body and parameters. I'm sorry. So I have the body, the content type. The content type, it's interesting. I could be running Python and Ruby rules in the same rules engine.
Oh, wow.
So I put that in there to show that you could run both at the same time. In the application domain, I have things like shopping cart, and I apologize, but my virtual machine is slow right now. The shopping cart object has access through this engine class I've written to something, a rule called apply discounts. And when the rule body changes, when I press that commit changes button, it fires off this delegate, which forces that rule to be, that function to be called. And of course, in the shopping cart, I have line items. Each line item has quantity and product and all of those kinds of things. And this is the really interesting part. The thing that I'm going to inject into the Python space is called a symbol dictionary. And I essentially just create a cart object, and I take a reference to my shopping cart, my C-sharp allocated plain old .NET shop object, shopping cart. Mm-hmm. I pass that into the symbol dictionary and then assign it. And then essentially when the Python code is instantiated through the engine, that shopping cart becomes available by that name, cart. That's why you saw that I could use it in the Python code that way. I could say cart.lineItems, or say for each line item in cart.lineItems. And that iteration over those line items in the cart just works.
Hmm.
Right? So the engine class that I wrote is just really a simple wrapper around the rule and the symbol dictionary. And this is reusable. You can get this code off my site. I look for required parameters, if any exist, based on the rule object. I then create a script engine, and I create that from configuration, because I'm in the configuration, I'm specifying that I really want the Python engine. And this is where, for example, I'm linking in the Python engine to respond or be available for the .py extension. I could add other languages right here, like Ruby or Scheme or Boo or whatever happens to be available on the DLR at the time. Those could actually be listed here alongside Python, and I could instantiate and run rules in those languages as well. After the script engine has been created, it's just a matter of creating a script scope, and then inside that script scope, I inject that symbol dictionary. Sorry, I've lost my cursor. There we go. There we go. My apologies. There we go. So I create the script source, and then I say create the script source from a string. That's the actual rule body. And then I've got some exception handling in there. I say execute, and that does it. I basically take that scope object on the source and say execute it. And the cart, the shopping cart, which I allocated in C#, which has been injected into that source, or into that scope, is now able to access it and apply those discounts.
So, Kevin, in your particular example, it looks like what you're running is basically a client application. But so, where is your code actually executing? Is this running in a .NET app domain, or where is that executing in the case of your example here?
Well, in the case of this example, it's just a Windows Forms application.
Okay.
So this module called Application Domain just has my application objects like shopping carts and line items and products.
Okay. I wanted to bring that up because I know one of the things that I've discussed with folks in the past is the fact that the DLR is also something that that can run in the context of a browser, such as with I think Silverlight 2 kind of brought that to the fore.
Right.
And one of the interesting scenarios that people have discussed, and actually it was funny because I was at a Ruby event last year, and somebody brought it up without my even mentioning it, that you know, one of the scenarios they were talking about was taking advantage of the DLR to do something, to do what they called ARAC, so asynchronous Ruby and XML. So essentially doing AJAX, but because they didn't want to do JavaScript, they could just do it with Ruby. So is that something you've looked at all in terms of the dynamic languages, or are you focused more on the putting it in a Windows Forms app and that kind of thing?
Well, no. In fact, the Windows Forms app is probably the least likely thing that I would do at this point. Most of the coding that I do, because of my aversion to user interfaces, just because I'm so not good at it, is I write a lot of code in the middle tier. So I'm really focused on, you know, business rule systems, high performance transactional systems, and this is what really led me to investigating what is the real cost of using languages like Python and Ruby in a high performance environment. Obviously, running a rule in a Windows application, you know, I'm probably not going to be running thousands or millions of transactions per second in that user interface. But in a service application where I might want to script some things with Python, for example, it is very important to be able to move beyond hundreds or thousands of transactions per second to potentially millions per second. So that's what really led me on this journey to discovering what are the limits. And I have some other demos that show that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. In Silverlight in particular, you know, if you told me 5 years ago that Microsoft was going to bring Ruby and Python to essentially every desktop, I would have laughed. But here we are. And Microsoft has delivered Python and Ruby to essentially every desktop that runs Safari, the Mozilla browsers, or Internet Explorer. And it's there available in the Silverlight client. It's fantastic.
Right. Yeah, the Ruby folks that I was talking to were kind of, when the guy brought that up, they're like, really? You can do that?
Absolutely. I love it. It's a real coup in my view, because I just love to see Microsoft leading in that way. You know, Microsoft catches a lot of flack for not adopting this or that. You pick your, you know, whatever it is of the day. And to say that we brought Ruby and Python to the desktop first for millions and millions of users is a great win.
It's all about choice, right?
That's right. So, yeah, I've done some applications in Silverlight, and as you can tell already, I'm more of a Python fan than a Ruby fan. I think Ruby's a great language, but Python is a very mature language, actually. It's been around for almost a couple decades now, and it's got a lot of adoption from a lot of different applications out in the real world. not that Ruby doesn't, but Python is really mature, mm-hmm. And in that respect, I have not done ARACs, but more APAX, if you will.
There you go.
Where I've scripted my Silverlight applications with Python.
Yeah, and that's kind of a really exciting opportunity, because when you start putting that combination together, I think people have a tendency sometimes to look at, you know, the browser and AJAX and Silverlight and, you know, and the dynamic languages, and see them sort of as distinct and separate technologies, mm-hmm. You know, but because of the Silverlight to HTML DOM bridge, you have the ability with a Silverlight-based application to use as much or as little Silverlight as possible. You can simply use the Silverlight runtime to host the dynamic stuff and then take advantage of that DOM bridge to really use the power of Ruby or Python to manipulate your DOM elements. But then if you need the ability to do some of the stuff that Silverlight enables but isn't as easy to do in HTML, you've got that in your hip pocket. So it really becomes sort of almost a Swiss Army knife of technology in a sense.
Well, and I think the level of integration is fantastic with the bridge, because I can write Python code that interacts cleanly with code written in C# or VB, mm-hmm. Which also could be working with JavaScript code or Ruby code. And they're all really first-class citizens. and Silverlight. And it really, again, goes back to what I said before. As an application developer or an application architect, it gives you the flexibility of saying, this part really needs to be done in Visual Basic, but this part could be done in Ruby. You know, this, and maybe the Ruby is a tiny part of that application today, but if it solves a key problem, it's great to have that capability.
Right.
Something that might be hard to do, you know, in Visual Basic or C#. So, how do you want to move on?
Sure. Well, what's the next project you have? Is it sort of featuring some of the new .NET 4 benefits of using dynamic languages?
Yeah, so this next one, I'm going to divert a little bit away from Python and Ruby for a minute and say, you know, C# 4 is becoming a dynamic language. We have a new keyword in C# 4, which is dynamic. Hmm. And objects allocated as dynamic get special treatment at runtime. So the example I'll give here is, let's say I have some XML that looks like this, where I have, you know, I have books and IDs with ISBN numbers and a collection of authors that have names and email addresses where the names have multiple parts. This isn't a very complex XML schema, if you will, but it does require that I know how to parse XML to sort of traverse this document. What I'd really like to be able to do is I'd like to treat this XML more like a Fluent interface. So, for example, if I were to load this XML up in an application, let's say I have that XML blob we just looked at with the books. Let's say I were to wrap it with something I'll call dynamic XML, and then we'll treat that as a dynamic object, which we'll call DX. In this case, what if I could just say, give me the first book, and among the authors, give me the first author, and I would like to set the middle name of that person to Zebediah. Well, that's an interesting kind of Fluent way to look at the XML.
Right.
Well, this is actually possible, and this dynamic XML class I'm going to show you here is a C# 4 class that is written to allow exactly that. So, for example, I have some constructors here, and these constructors allow me to take text or XML elements or lists of XML elements and store them in this collection internally. Right? Because I know I'm manipulating XML, so I have this construct for manipulating them. Next, I have a function called getMember or tryGetMember, and what this does is it takes what's called a binder, and this binder is essentially handed to me by the base class, which is called Dynamic Object. Dynamic Object is a class that's a helper class that's in the framework that allows us to answer questions like, if someone used a dot operator on a dynamic object and they were trying to get a specific member, how would you write code to satisfy that condition? Or, for example, if someone used a property name after the dot operator and they were using the equal sign to set a value in, mm-hmm. how would we implement that dynamically? And so this dynamic object based class and the underlying DLR capability gives us the capability of doing exactly that. In this case, I'm going to say, if the name that's being sought in the get is value or count, I have sort of some special implementations for those. Otherwise, this is XML that I'm really handling. So maybe they're after an attribute of that XML, and let's go see if we can find it. If we can't get that, then they're probably looking for descendants of that XML node. So let's go get that set of descendants and then wrap it as another dynamic XML object. And that's what allows us to do this kind of parsing. When I'm getting values, essentially think of it this way. When you use the dot operator in C# or VB, you're essentially saying the thing on the left has something called the thing on the right, and I would like to go get it. And this code, because the object is dynamic, allows that to happen. It knows it's dealing with XML, so it says go get an attribute, and if you can't find the attribute, go get the descendants and wrap them and return them. So as I continue to use that dot operator moving down the line, or the indexing operators, we can look at those in a moment, my helper functions there in the dynamic object derivative perform that work for me.
Okay. Now,
obviously, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, let's talk about this from the experience of a developer writing code. One of the things about static classes and interfaces is you expect IntelliSense to give you a list when you hit the dot. I'm assuming that's not the case here when you say DX dot and you start typing book bracket zero bracket. Is that
right? Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Right. If we were to say, you know, DX dot, it says this operation will be resolved at runtime.
Wow.
Because the compiler, I mean, the current environment, the editing environment, has no idea what that thing is there.
Sure.
It's only at runtime that will be known.
And what if you ask for something that doesn't exist?
Well, then you'd get an error, an exception that says member does not exist.
Okay.
You get a runtime error. So that's a little scary. I understand from a static development standpoint, if you come from that kind of background like I do, that's a little scary at first. But the reality is that a lot of this kind of work is going on in the real world with languages like Python and Ruby, and people aren't chopping their limbs off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you get something wired up to a particular type or a particular instance of a thing at runtime, the chances that it's going to go wrong are essentially limited by the domain you're in.
Right.
So in the case of XML, if I were feeding dynamic XML in here, it's very possible that someone could feed me XML that does not contain a book, book object or book element within that XML, and that would actually throw an exception.
Now, would you put your try-catch for your exception in your main code, or would you put it in the dynamic XML class where it's trying to figure out what property or method has been requested?
I would put it in the consuming code.
Okay.
Because essentially here I'm saying I expect the XML that I'm wrapping to have a book element. And if it doesn't happen to have it, I would want to put that try-catch here and then have, because essentially, you know, think of it this way, the dynamic object itself, that dynamic XML class, it has a range of things that it might need to deal with. And of course, if it gets to the case in the state machine that says that thing just doesn't exist, it needs to be able to handle that in a routine way. And the routine way is throw an exception. So I would recommend, just from a design perspective, that you handle those exceptions in the consuming code.
Got it. And another question, when you're thinking about what you just requested, dx.book sub-zero,
uh-huh.
That thing is another instance of dynamic XML, right?
It is. The only case where that is not true here is if I return an attribute.
This is
kind of interesting because if I find an actual attribute by the name that you're seeking, I just set it. The interesting part of that, though, is that the chain continues to be dynamic even if the object that's returned is a static, well-known type.
Okay.
So the rule number one in dynamic development with C# is the fruit of anything that's dynamic is dynamic, and it will stay dynamic even if you're introducing static objects, static or well-known objects in the call chain, as it were.
Yep.
Right?
The way I wrap my brain around this is when you're hitting the dot and you're looking for something, it's like calling the main desk of a company instead of knowing the direct extension for somebody at the company.
Right, so here's the dilemma. When you're doing that, obviously that's an expensive operation, right? Going through the directory service.
Uh-huh.
And so Microsoft is really focused on that dispatch mechanism. The DLR is made up of several key components, one of which is what we call call site caching or polymorphic inline caching. You might hear that term sometimes. The idea is that as those pathways are executed or exercised on the call sites, like if I say, you know, dx.book, that's what's called a call site. And that call site has the ability to cache a delegate which can assist in the call to the actual dynamic object on the other end, or the dynamically typed object on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
The performance that's yielded out of that caching mechanism is phenomenal, to the tune of, in traditional static to dynamic interactions like language-level integration, we tend to expect hundreds of transactions per second as being possible through that pathway. Like from static to dynamic, I can do that a few hundred times per second in most environments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With that call site caching and action binder caching that goes on in the DLR, we pump that up from hundreds to millions.
Wow.
And it's not quite as fast as the native .NET code yet, but it's really, really impressive, to the tune of about 5 to 10,000 times the performance that we've been, we've traditionally experienced with dynamic languages.
That's pretty exciting.
It is very exciting. I have a demo that'll show that, but I just wanted to show real quickly before we get out of this demo. If you're sitting there wondering how does the sub-zero work here,
mm-hmm.
One of the other things is in a DLR, any dynamic object can also act like a collection. And that's simple to do. We can just say implement the getIndex function. Just like we have getMember, we have getIndex.
Okay.
We get a list of indices that we're seeking, and then we just sort of index into that and return those elements wrapped, in this case, as dynamic XML.
So all of those try, get, whatever, they have to implement they have to return a Boolean to be true or false, right? That's whether they could successfully find a thing that was requested.
Right. So here's the code running, and I'll leave it up while I'm talking about that. This is basically iterating through the books and through the authors and just dumping it as text just to see that the test program is doing that.
Yeah.
Now, you see the try get member and the try get index? Those are all based on the fact that they're virtual functions in the dynamic object base class. Microsoft looked at what it took to essentially write dynamic objects in C#, and it gets really kind of interesting and hard to write to understand all of the expression tree logic that you'd need to know to pull that off. So this dynamic object base class really is a nice simple wrapper that will hand you the binder and then lets you return true or false if you have success implementing that function. And that then is called by the underlying bind version of that function. So for the try get member, there's a bind get member underneath that's invoking it. It's just sort of calling out to give you a place to stub in the things that you want to provide.
Ah.
It abstracts away your needing to understand expression trees, and it also gives you a nice way to hook just the functions that you want to override. If you didn't have that really nice dynamic object base class, you'd have to understand all that stuff, and you'd have to write all 12 of those methods, for indexing and deleting members and adding members and all those things. And most people just don't have time to think about it in that level of depth.
Sure.
So you can see here in the dump of this, I was able to successfully change the middle name of that first author, and then use essentially a for loop to drive through and iterate through that XML. So not only can I read the XML, I can write to it using this fluent syntax.
Got it. Is there a way to identify whether something is a getter or a setter only when you're using some of those properties, virtual properties, I guess?
So you're asking on a dynamic object if you can determine whether it supports set or get at runtime?
Yeah. Or make it do so.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to think about that a bit, but I think the short answer would be no. But, of course, you'll find out when you try to invoke it, you'll get an exception if it doesn't support it.
Yeah.
Again, this kind of programming has been going on in the dynamic world for a long time, and people who work in that world are very happy with it. The real challenge for VB and C# developers is getting comfortable with the idea that, one, I might not have IntelliSense support for some of the things that I do here. And two, if I make a mistake, I have to have good exception handling, just like any other case.
Right.
Right, to deal with what might happen if that dynamic object can't resolve.
So, Kevin, one of the questions we have from attendee, and I'm curious myself, is how does this work in terms of debugging? I mean, are you able to show us how this looks in the debugger?
I don't have a version of the DLR installed that lets me do that here in this virtual machine because of the collection of demos that I put together. I had to use a specific version that doesn't support it yet. But it is possible, and Harry Pearson, who is on the DLR team, he's actually a manager of the team. He has a site, the DevHawk site, and he has some fantastic articles on there about how to do DLR-based debugging. The forthcoming 2.6 release of Iron Python, which is went to release candidate yesterday, I think. Glenn, did you mention that?
Oh, no, we haven't mentioned that yet.
I forget who it was. Maybe it was Andrew. But in any case, the Iron Python 2.6 went to RC1 yesterday.
Yeah, we were talking about it before the call, but yep, that's right. It just is released up on CodePlex.
And it has fantastic debugger support built in. So I'd encourage people to go to the to DevHawk, Harry Pearson's site, and take a look at that. It is possible to set breakpoints in your Python or Ruby code, for example, and inspect and do all the things that you'd expect in a rich debugging experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have somebody pointing out that you probably couldn't even do a get type on a dynamic type. Is that true?
Well, what's going to happen when you go to get the type is it's going to say it's an object,
assistant.object. Sure.
Because understand that when you mark something as dynamic in C# 4, you're really getting the type of the thing is actually system.object with a special attribute called the dynamic attribute applied to it. In addition, any utilization of that object generates what's called a call site. And that call site is where this caching mechanism that I'd like to show in this third demo if we have time.
Sure, we do. We've got maybe 7 or 8 minutes left, so we can jump in.
Okay. So that call site is where that caching mechanism is sort of hooked in. So what I want to do, let me just run the demo first to show you what's going on, and then we can maybe, if we have time, step back into the code.
Sure.
It's pretty straightforward. In this demo, I have 5 examples, 8 labeled A through E. And in the first one, I want to show you the effect of polymorphic inline caching. Now, in this demo, I've got a Python-based function that I'm invoking from C# as a dynamic type in C#. And that function sometimes returns integers, sometimes returns real numbers or floating point numbers, and sometimes returns strings. And what ends up happening is as I exercise that call path over and over and over again, the DLR will be looking at, through the call site, those pathways in determining the best way to wire up the call and the response. And you'll see through the performance the number of milliseconds for the call tightening up as I go through. So let's just go ahead and dive into it and see it. I'm going to invoke it here, and the first thing that comes back, in this case is going to be random, we'll see what it is a floating point number. 384 milliseconds. It's about a third of a second, and arguably very, very slow. The second time, that same data type returns in a millisecond.
Ooh.
If randomly an integer is returned on the next call, you can see it took a little bit longer because what it essentially did was it exercised that pathway, that delegate that was built for the call in the call site. But it saw that the return type was different, so it had to make a decision and probably went to one of the other levels of caching and made some adjustments, which took a little longer, and it added a few milliseconds. But if I keep exercising that pathway, notice that that integer returns in 2 milliseconds. A string, which is now a new data type, takes a little longer, about 10 milliseconds. But as I keep exercising it and getting those same data types to return, notice they're now all coming back in what I can only measure with this timer as 0 or 1 millisecond. Because those pathways have been exercised enough, and those dynamic delegates that are being cached in the call site are allowing those to return faster because they're known pathways. Okay?
And that caching will only persist as long as the application is running, is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, it has its own rules. If I were to sit here for 10 minutes and execute it again, we might see it shoot back up to 100 milliseconds. So there's actually some timing built into the cache as well. So where this really comes in handy is when we do things iteratively. Obviously, calling a dynamic function once is interesting, but we don't really get the value of the caching mechanism until we call it over and over again. So let's run Okay, so this demo B that I'm running is 1 million iterations of managed power. So this is a C-sharp function taking a number and computing the power of that number a million times. And it returns in 246 milliseconds for a million iterations, which has an effective call rate of about 4 million calls per second. So that's what we're getting out of pure C-sharp, okay? Pure compiled C-sharp. Let's run that same thing dynamically. Let's run it again. I think the first, okay, so 752,000, 1.6. So we see it's sort of exercised now. So I can compare about 4 million calls in pure C-sharp to perform this function. The same number of calls across the boundary from C-sharp to Python a million times, right? Executing about at an effective rate of 1.6 million calls per second. Well, you might ask yourself, that's a little more than a 2-to-1 ratio.
Right.
Well, that seems like a lot until we, let's skip down to D here, or E, the last demo. Notice that I'm having to execute 1,000 iterations of the no-call site-based algorithm here. In other words, I'm calling across 1 million times into Python, but I'm not using call sites. This number that I'm yielding, about 240 calls per second, is really what we normally expect today in static to dynamic call integration.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why a lot of people look at dynamic languages and say, I can't use that in my application. It's just too slow.
Yeah.
Well, if you compare and contrast 240 to 1.6 million, granted it's not 4 million, but look at the difference.
Yeah, that's very significant.
It's phenomenal. And so this is why I'm encouraging people to take a second look at dynamic languages. If you sort of ventured down that pathway before, or someone told you, hey, don't do that because it's a performance nightmare, the folks on the DLR team have done a fantastic job of with the call site caching of making this an attractive option for an integration pattern, an architectural pattern.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. They recognize that as a deal breaker and focused a lot of resources on it.
Yeah. And so that's pretty much it. I just wanted to be able to compare and contrast, you know, a pure sort of funking across that static to dynamic boundary a bunch of times, and then comparing and contrasting that with being able to wire up the delegates, as it were, to make that so much faster in the DLR.
Sure.
It's phenomenal. It's, you know, getting 5 to 10,000 times boost in the performance makes it something that I think a lot of architects and senior developers who guide the architecture of projects should really be looking at.
Yes, and everybody should, if they're working with an architect, they should get them to watch a recording of this GeekSpeak and see those tests in action. So, Kevin, just to net out, what the new capabilities are coming in .NET 4 that you illustrated today? That's the dynamic C-sharp that we saw.
Yep.
As well as the call site caching, or is that in there now?
Call site caching is coming in DLR that's shipping with .NET 4.
Okay.
The DLR that you can download today and run with Visual Studio 2005 and 2008 in those languages is, I guess, technically the 0.9 release. And it has all of the integration facilities I showed in the first and third demos, albeit in different ways in the third one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the benefit of the call site caching unless you have the support from the underlying .NET framework, and then we're getting that in the 4.0 framework.
Got it. Excellent. Well, we're eating up that hour. It went by so fast. A lot of cool capabilities out of dynamic languages. Pretty exciting. And so we just brought everybody to a slide here that gives some useful links to primarily our GeekSpeak blog, where you can check in a couple of days for some resources related to today's GeekSpeak. You can also look for upcoming GeekSpeak webcasts at the URL here, or you can go to msdngeekspeak.com. We also have recordings of our show on Channel 9, just channel9.msdn.com/shows/GeekSpeak. My blog's here, Andrew's blog, as well as Kevin's blog, where, Kevin, you're hosting the source code as well.
Yeah, the source code is available. The latest set that I have out there is what I presented at the Raleigh Code Camp this past weekend, and you can go get it from there.
Okay.
And I also want to recommend one other resource for folks. There's a site that I run called Community Megaphone. It's at communitymegaphone.com. You can find out information on upcoming Geek Speaks, upcoming Code Camps, the MSDN road shows that both I and Glenn participate in, as well as lots of other developer and IT pro events.
Super. Yeah, that's a great site that Andrew put together for the community. All right, so at that point, thanks very much, Kevin, for coming on, and Andrew for co-hosting.
My pleasure. Always good to spend time with Kevin.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys.
Great. We'll toss it back over to Sydney to do some final wrap-up.